All right, so there was a large crowd that gathered around Jesus on that day. Although it wasn't really the size of the crowd that was unique, it was the makeup of the crowd, I think, that was kind of special. You see, on the one side, there were what they called the tax collectors and the sinners. These were the outcasts in so many places, and yet these were the people that just kept flocking to Jesus. On the other side, doing their best not to cross paths or, you know, accidentally touch any of the riffraff, were the religious crowd. These were the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And they were looking like peacocks strutting around in their, you know, colorful robes and their colorful hats. And Jesus, when he got in a situation like that, had an incredible way of seeing everyone. Jesus always saw both sides. And he had an incredible way of speaking to everyone. And he often did this by telling a story. And that's what Jesus does on this day. And he tells what may be his best story of all. It's about a father who loved two sons. And the younger son, I guess, was kind of like the sinners and the tax collectors in the crowd, because he was not known for making the best choices, right? He's not very good at making good decisions. In fact, he cooks up this crazy plan that he's going to go to his father and he's going to say, "Dad, I've decided that I'm ready to do life on my own. And so, you know, if you don't mind, I'd like to take my inheritance now, and then I'll just take that and get out of your hair." If you think that through, what a horrible thing that is to say. He's telling a person that I care more about your money than I actually care about spending time with you. In a way, he's saying, "Dad, I wish you were dead, because, you know, let's just fast forward to that and I'll take your stuff." But the dad loves the son, and so he gives him the money. And no surprise, the kid takes the cash and goes off. And before long, he spends it all, doing everything that his father taught him not to do, doing everything that his father hated, until before long, kid hits rock bottom and realizes, you know, things were not so bad with dad after all. And so he decides, "Hey, I'm going to go back and, you know, I'll say sorry, and maybe dad will at least welcome me back as, you know, a worker at his farm or something like that." So he works up this speech and he heads home, and of course he's not sure what he's going to say, but as he's getting closer, before he even turns down the driveway, he sees just something that's amazing, because booking towards him is his dad. And his dad runs up to him, and with tears of love and joy in his eyes, he throws his arms around his son and he says, my son, I can't believe you're home. Welcome home. I'm going to throw a party for you." It's a great story. Only problem is, remember, there is the older son as well. And I guess the older son was like the religious folks that were standing nearby Jesus on that day. Because these are the people that had, the older son is the one who'd stayed by his dad's side. He'd followed all the rules. He'd defended the family name. He had already written off, you know, his younger brother is dead, which, you know, he deserved, right? And so now dad is going to welcome this punk back into the family. And so the older son goes to the dad and he says, "Dad, what are you doing? Don't you remember? I'm the good kid. I followed all the rules. I'm not like my brother over there who did all that crazy stuff. I deserve the party, not him." And can you believe it? In this story that Jesus tells, the father sides with the younger brother. And the older brother, if you read the story all the way through, misses out on the party altogether. And the crowds of sinners and tax collectors keep flocking to Jesus. And the religious people decide enough is enough. And they decide that we're going to get rid of this guy once and for all. Well, that, of course, is the story from Luke chapter 15. It's one of Jesus' most significant teachings of all. It's what we call the prodigal son. But it's important for our study today in the book of Romans, because years later, there is another religious Pharisee named Saul. And this guy is an older brother to the max. But he meets Jesus. And Jesus has a way of transforming your life, and Jesus has a way of transforming the way you look at things. And so Saul the Pharisee, in this major plot twist in the whole story, plot twist in Saul's life, Saul the Pharisee becomes Paul, the number one messenger of the good news of the grace that Jesus talks about in this story. And then years later, using that brilliant mind that Paul had honed as a Pharisee, as an older brother, he actually takes the same concept that Jesus taught in that story, and he makes it a part of his case that he's making to the people of Rome, the city in the heart of the empire, about why they should trust in the good news. And so we're in this study in the book of Romans, if you're just joining us today, that's called The Letter That Changed the World. And we have said that the book of Romans is kind of like this courtroom argument that Paul is making for the good news, for the gospel. And over the last couple of weeks, we've been making the point that before Paul can get to why the good news is so good, you have to roll around for a little bit and why the bad news is so bad. Because the opening point in this long argument that Paul is making that we're going to get to throughout the whole year, but the opening part of the argument that Paul is making for the good news is all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Not real happy news for us, but it's important news. And Paul is kind of setting the stage for why we need this good news. And so he says, before you can get it, you have to understand that all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Now, I don't know about you, but I know myself and I know others. Nobody really likes being told that they're a sinner and they fall short of the glory of God. We may know it to be true, but we just don't like to be told it. And so Paul, like a courtroom lawyer, anticipates some of the arguments that people might make about this. And before they can even open their mouths and voice these arguments, Paul kind of counters the arguments. And that's what you really have in Romans 1 through 3. So at the second half of Romans 1, Paul anticipates the objection that the Gentiles would make, who would say, well, we didn't know. We didn't know God. We didn't know what he had to say and all these things. So we just did what seemed right to us. But remember, Paul writes and he says, no, from creation, all of us know. The problem is we suppress the truth because we want to exchange the truth of God for a lie. Well, then you get to the start of chapter 2, and the next objection is actually from the Jewish people who say, well, you know, we're not, you know, we probably don't fall short of the glory of God because at least we're not as bad as those people over there. All those Gentiles that you wrote about, Paul, we're not as bad as them, right? And Paul's answer is, well, God doesn't really grade on a curve. God's standard is perfection. And today we're going to look at the third objection that Paul anticipates, again from the Jews, who make an argument that people have been making for generations. And the argument is this. You can't be talking about us when you say all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God because we're religious people. And people still make that argument today. Paul can't be talking about us. We're churchgoers, right? We're church folks. But Paul answers and he says, not only can religion not save you, but religion, get this, actually has a way of inoculating us from the true gospel. It actually has a way of offering us a false hope and a false security that sometimes ends up even keeping us away from God. Kind of reminds me of a story that I've just remembered for years, and it goes back to when I was the youth pastor at the church, and we took a big group of students all the way out to Washington, D.C. for this big national conference, and it was a big deal to take them all the way out there. We had a great time. We went to the conference, but we also, you know, went and saw the sights, and one day we were out on the National Mall on a bright spring day, and the kids were off kind of doing their thing, and I was standing over there, and a police officer comes up, and the police officer comes up to me, and he says, you know, hey, do you know those kids over there? I looked at them and looked at the officer and thought that through. And I said, no, I have never seen them. Officer, I have no idea who those kids are. And he says, well, you know, if you do know who they are, you should probably tell them to stop buying the fake sunglasses. Because what had happened is there were guys on the mall that were selling these knockoff Oakley sunglasses. And every kid in the group paid $10 to buy these fake Oakley sunglasses that looked like $200 sunglasses, right? It looked like $150 sunglasses, but they got them for 10 bucks. And the officer said, well, the problem is not only are they fake and probably stolen, but he says, if they wear those out in the sun, it will actually hurt their eyes. It will damage their eyes because they may look good, but they don't offer the security that you think that they would. And I think that's kind of what Paul is saying about religion. He says this stuff can look good, but if you wear this stuff out in the sun, it can even damage you. So now as you think about this, you may be surprised and even a little confused, especially if you're kind of checking out Christianity or new to the Bible. I'm so glad that you're here today. But you may be a little surprised and even confused to hear us talk about religion in kind of a negative way, because Steve did that last week from Romans chapter 2. In fact, some of you may say, well, you know, hey, isn't Christianity a religion? And it is, in fact, the world's largest religion. It is. So you might say, well, isn't the church a religious organization? And if you think it through, you might say, hey, how about you, preacher boy? You seem to be the most religious of them all. So what's the deal with that? And I think what Paul is saying here is not that those things can't be important. Paul is actually writing about the importance of a strong church, right? Paul is talking about the pure and holy and set apart life. But what he is saying is if you think you can work your way to God and try to please God through religious actions and rituals and activities, you're missing the point and you're going to miss the good news. And so what I'm going to do is I want to go ahead and our outline is super simple today. I want to read this whole section. It's kind of a long section. I want to read all of that. And then I want us to see three ways that I want to suggest that Paul is saying religion can actually offer us a false hope and sometimes keep us away from God. So we're in Romans chapter 2, beginning in verse 17. I'm reading from the New International Version. Like I said, I'll read the whole passage all the way through to the end of the chapter. And it goes like this. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of little children, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourselves? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And then he talks about this religious ritual of circumcision. He says, circumcision has value if you observe the law. But if you break the law, you have become as though you have not been circumcised. So then, if those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirements, will they be regarded as those who were circumcised? The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will condemn you who, even though you have the written code and circumcision, are a lawbreaker. A person is not a Jew who is one only outwardly, nor is circumcision merely an outward and physical. No, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a person's praise is not from other people, but from God. And so let me first of all just say, if you had a little bit of a hard time tracking with that, you are not alone. Pretty much a lot of Paul's writing, but especially Romans, you need to read it more than once. And sometimes you need to read it, you know, a few times. And Paul was definitely inspired by the Holy Spirit. It's brilliant what he writes when you can unpack it. But even though it was inspired, Paul loved a run-on sentence. I mean, and he was a bit ADD, would jump around from place to place. So what I want to do is I want to break this all down by looking at three ways that religion can offer us false hope. Even because it serves as kind of a vaccination, if you will, from a real relationship with God through Christ. And so the first false hope that he gets at is this idea that I can rewrite with God because of my race or because of my nationality or my religious denomination. So if you look at verse 17 there, it says, now, if you call yourself a Jew, and you see the Jews, they were putting their hope in the fact that they were Jewish by birth, saying, I was born into this, and so because I was born this way, I am one of God's people. In fact, a common Jewish prayer was, at that time, was, God, thank you so much that I am not a Gentile, right? Thank you that I'm not like those other people. I was born this way. The problem is when we put our hope in, whether it's a nationality or a race or even a religious denomination or a religious background, it leads to the same kind of pride that we see in the older brother. And so if we say I can be right with God because of my race, one of the things that it leads to is a pride that looks down on other people. And that can be a hindrance to us knowing God and the gospel. And in fact, this can be true for us as Americans. We tend to think that as Americans, and especially if you were born into a Christian family or a family with Christian background, you think, well, because I'm American, because I was born like this, surely I am a Christian. And yet the reality is that's not the way it works, right? Each person has to make that decision for themselves. And yet we tend to kind of have this pride that we're better than other people. I remember I experienced this a little bit a few years ago. I was in Tanzania, and I was teaching at the Hope of the Nations Bible College. And as Americans, when you travel overseas, especially to a country that has so much poverty, and especially a country that quite honestly has so much what we would call dysfunction, it's really easy to kind of go in with this attitude of superiority. And I must have gone in there with this I'm American superior attitude. But as I was teaching my class, I remember several times the students saying something like, "We are really praying for you, and we're really praying for the church in America." And I heard them say it a few times, but after they'd said it several times, I thought to myself, and I didn't say this, but my thought was, why are you praying for us? We should be praying for you. I mean, I knew these students. I knew that many of them didn't have the resources to provide, you know, food and shelter for their family. I knew that many of them had lost family members to AIDS or to malaria. Some of them had malaria even at that moment. Many of them faced persecution in their villages or pressure from witch doctors and all sorts of things. And so I thought to myself, you know, we should be praying for you. Why are you praying for us as Christians in the United States? And finally, I asked them, and they said this. They said, "Because we know how hard it must be to be a Christian in America these days, where you face the temptations of wealth and comfort and power so that you don't have to depend on God." It stuck with me since then. They said, "Your culture seems to run counter to the true gospel of humility, purity, and dependence upon Christ." And so Paul says, it's a false hope if you're putting your hope in a race, in a nationality, in a religious background. And it could keep us away from the true gospel. Second false hope that he gets to in this long passage that we just read is that I can work my way to God by rule following or by obedience to the law. And he spends a lot of time talking about that. Now, of course, in Judaism, Judaism was built on God's law. And God's law is perfect. It is. But even if you take the most basic part of the law, you take the Ten Commandments, no person can live up to it. Try running your day through the Ten Commandments at the end of the day today and see how you did in that. Every day we're going to fall short of even the most basic part of the law. Now, falling short of the law was meant to drive us to God. It was meant to drive us to ask for forgiveness, to seek Him, to want to know Him more. But instead, because of this fallen nature in us, this kind of striving for the law led to a couple different things. One, it leads to outward legalism. And so we kind of create all these systems where, look how we're following the law. But the other thing that it leads to is because we know we can't truly live up to the law and those things, is we create almost a picture of that, like even though we're not following it, we portray that we're following it. It's what we call hypocrisy. Right? And if my relationship with God is built on following the rules and obedience to the law, before long, it's going to lead to hypocrisy in your life, trying to say, look, I've got this together, when inwardly we know that we don't. And Paul says, if you set yourself up as guides and teachers of the law, but you're a stumbling block, just like everyone else. There's that long section where he says, you say you don't steal. You say you don't commit adultery. You say you don't love idols, but you do all of those things. So last week, if you remember back, Steve did a great job teaching us through that, and he made that shared that quote from the book Unchristian. And this is based on a survey that was done of Christian and non-Christian people. And basically, what they found is something that we've unfortunately known for a while, is that Christian people and non-Christian people really are not that different in many areas of life. So he said, Christians tend to use less profanity in public. They give more to charity. They attend church more, those kind of things. But then the same study said that Christians watch pornography, get drunk, lied at pretty much the same rate as non-Christians. And this hypocrisy has done for Christianity exactly This hypocrisy has done the exact opposite that Christianity is supposed to do. Christianity is meant to be a light. It's meant to draw people to God. But instead, what we see is it pushes people away. And this isn't new with us. Look at verse 24. Verse 24 says, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So in other words, he says to the Jews, you guys are saying you're doing all these things. You're not doing them. Everybody sees it. And God's name is blasphemed because of your hypocrisy. Well, this same kind of thing is true today. In fact, just last year, an author by the name of Scott Sauls came out with a book that I just started reading. It's a great book, A Gentle Answer, Our Secret Weapon in an Age of Us Versus Them, or Us Against Them. And it quotes, again, a familiar study about young people leaving the church. And whatever the statistics are, we see that far too many young adults hit college, hit their 20s, and turn away from the church and even leave the church. And so he digs into that study a little bit, and he says these are the top three reasons why young adults are leaving. And he quotes things, again, that may not be a surprise to you. The number three reason he says that young people are leaving the church is there's an arrogance in the church. They weren't observing a humility among people, right? They weren't observing a compassion, especially for the poor, especially for the underprivileged, especially for those that were different than us. And so it didn't come across as compassionate, it came across as arrogant, and we're better than you. Second reason that young adults said that they were leaving the church is because of politics. They said that to them it just seemed like the church was too intertwined with partisan politics. And then the number one reason, and the reason I'm sharing this in the first place, is according to Romans 24, apparently was the same thing that was happening in Paul's day, which is hypocrisy. They saw that religion was built on obeying rules, and yet their lives didn't look any different. And so what's the point? Now, I get that this is all pretty heavy, and it should be. This is an important topic. It's important for us to look at our lives and to take a look at that hypocrisy. But I want to get a little more lighthearted for a second, because I saw an example of this, and maybe you saw this. It was all over the internet in the last couple weeks. It was a lawyer in Texas, maybe you saw this, who just the perils of the COVID year and Zoom everything, he was in a Zoom courtroom hearing, and he got his filter stuck. Take a look at this.
Mr. Ponton, I believe you have a filter turned on in the video settings. You might want to...
Can you hear me, Judge?
I can hear you. I think it's a filter.
It is, and I don't know how to remove it. I've got my assistant here. She's trying to, but I'm prepared to go forward with it. I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
That's the best part.
I can see that. I think if you click the up arrow next to this.
All right. Isn't that classic? And what's so funny about it, first of all, the guy in the upper right who's just trying to be serious about the whole thing, but the guy says, I'm prepared to go forward with this. Like, he's going to make his legal argument. He's going to use all his lawyerly words, but nobody's listening to him because he looks like a cat. And like I said, it's a kind of a lighthearted example of the way things are, right? We're ready to go forward with our argument. We're ready to use all our words, but it's not matching up because the words don't match the picture. And maybe there's a filter on that we need to adjust. And that's what hypocrisy does with the church. Hey, that was kind of a lighthearted example. Let me share a more, I guess what you might call kind of intense example of that. And it is... from an article that I read recently, sorry about that, let me kind of open this up. An article that I read recently about Frederick Douglass. Of course, Frederick Douglass was the abolitionist in the 1800s, a former slave, and he was a slave into his 20s and experienced just tons of atrocities. Everything you could imagine, he saw it. And in his early 20s, he escaped. He went on to become one of the great voices in the abolitionist movement. He actually met Abraham Lincoln, spoke to Abraham Lincoln. And as a strong Christian, one of his most common arguments was against slavery, was it that he shared with both black and white people. He said it was about the difference that he said he saw in the Christianity of the land and the Christianity of Christ. He said, what I see, what I observe in this land that I'm living in and the Christianity that's here is different than the Christianity of Christ. You see, after all the suffering and pain that he endured, and he endured it all, his problem wasn't with Jesus. His problem wasn't with the Bible. His problem wasn't with Christianity. It was with hypocrisy. This is what the article says, and it quotes his words. It says, he condemned what he called corrupt, slave-holding, woman-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity present in America. He blasted the man who wields the blood-clotted cowskin during the week, which would be like the leather whip, who wields the leather whip during the week and then fills the pulpit on Sunday and claims to be a minister of the meek and lowly Jesus. He derided the slave owner as one who covers his infernal business with the garb of Christianity. And so obviously that's kind of an intense example, but that same kind of thing is still true, and that people claim to be Christian and claim to follow the rules and follow the laws, but instead what people see is as a hypocrisy. And Paul says, if you're building your life on following the rules, not that the rules are bad, but you're building your life on a false hope. Paul says you set yourself up for a false hope. And then the third false hope that he gets to is that I can know God through rituals or religious activities. So Paul calls out what the Jews that were hiding behind the ritual of circumcision. And we won't spend a lot of time on circumcision, but basically what he says is circumcision was in fact given as an outward sign of the covenant between God and his people. Circumcision was never meant to justify a person on its own, right? Circumcision didn't make you right. It was a sign or a symbol of what was meant to be an inward relationship with God. And that's what Paul is really getting at, this inward relationship with God. Because in our world today, we can still put false hope in religious rituals and everything from baptism, which, you know, is a big deal. We're Baptists, right? Or communion, or even just attending church or putting money in the offering. And here's the thing, all those and many other spiritual disciplines are good things. They can be great, but none of those are the goal on their own, right? None of those things are the goal of all of this. The goal is to know God and to walk with God through Jesus Christ and an inward transformation that takes place in our heart. And that's what changed Paul. And that's the story that Jesus tells about the younger brother who experiences that grace. And Paul says, if you're building your life on all of these things, you're going to miss it. He says, a person in verse 28, a person is not a Jew who is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly. And I love this phrase. And circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. And so Paul is pretty hard on religion. Last week and this week, he's pretty hard on religion. And he says all of these things, whether it's race or rules or rituals, the thing is, those are not bad things, right? They can be good things if they reflect the inward change of a forgiven heart, which comes from the grace of God through the good news that he's writing about. And that's what he's getting at. He's getting at all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And so all of us need God's grace. Well, as we close, I actually want to take us out of the book of Romans, because as I said, Paul's kind of hard on religion. I think that's good for us to think that through. But there's another book of the Bible that offers a little bit different take on religion. And I want to close on, I guess, what you might call a more positive note, because in the book of James, Jesus' half-brother James writes, and he writes about the potential positive of religion. So James chapter 1, if you want to follow along, they're pretty familiar verses. James chapter 1, verse 26 says, those who consider themselves religious and yet who do not keep a tight rein on their tongues, deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. So that's the same kind of argument that Paul is making. You can say you're religious, but if your tongue is just going off saying all kinds of stuff, you know, that's a worthless thing. But this is where I wanted us to see verse 27, because he says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So did you catch that? There is a religion that is of value. But here's the thing. It's not just that caring for widows and orphans is this religious activity. What James is talking about is when you truly surrender your heart to Christ, when you have that transformed gospel life that the book of Romans is all about, he says you're going to begin to have God's heart, and you're going to have God's heart for those that are in need. You're going to have a heart for the widows, and you're going to have a heart for the orphan, and you're going to want to keep yourself from being polluted by the world. And I was thinking of this for a number of reasons, but I was thinking a little bit about it because, as you guys know, this week is the funeral for Rick Furman. And if you didn't know, Rick was really the face of First Baptist Church in a pretty big way for a number of years because he was kind of the head usher for, or one of the head ushers for really the last 15 years. So it's going to be a tough day for us to have that service for Rick and someone who made a huge impact in this community, a huge impact in this church, and clearly on my life. But for Rick, that idea of being an usher, which is where so many of us know him in that role as the usher, the one who welcomed you. For Rick, being an usher was never about passing out a bulletin. Mm-hmm. It was never about helping someone find their seat. He did those things. But he was at the door because he wanted to make sure that every person felt welcomed in the church family, especially if you were a widow, especially if you were an orphan or in any category that required some sort of special attention and some sort of special love. He made an effort to welcome every kid into church, and that wasn't easy. He was 6'5", but he would look those little kids in the eyes and make sure that every kid felt welcomed into the family of God. He gently welcomed every elderly person. He went out of his way to show special honor and care for every single parent, right? He saw that. And he was right there. On every child with a special need, you were special to him. For years, Rick worked in the high school ministry. He loved every student. He loved my own kids who were just devastated by this. Mm-hmm. But especially if you were a young man and maybe didn't have a father at home, or you were a young man who maybe didn't have a great example of a father, you could count on Rick being there. To me, that is what James is getting at when he talks about a pure religion and a faultless religion. But here's what you need to know about that. For Rick, all those things, and we could go on for days talking about those kind of things, none of those were a religious checklist for him. None of those, I mean, sure, sometimes you're faithful, but for him, he experienced the transformation of the grace that he received, and he understood that he had been forgiven, and he had been set free, and that Christ had transformed his life. I remember his baptism in this church maybe 15 years ago. And because he'd experienced that transformation, he wanted to pass that on. And that is a pure and a faultless religion, because that's the religion of the gospel. So thanks, you guys, for listening. Let's pray together. God, I thank you so much for the message of Romans. This is a deep and a somewhat long argument, Paul, that Paul is making about our need for the gospel, and yet each and every part of it is important. So, Father, I pray for each person listening here today that your word would be alive in our hearts and that we would know what it means to truly walk with you. Father, give us special attention to what it means to receive your forgiveness and your grace and to walk in those things. We thank you for the example of Rick and so many countless others in this church that have just shown us what it means to live a transformed life. And we want to see that as well. So I pray for each person here today that you would guide and lead us into all truth and that we would know the power of the risen Jesus. Amen.